Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we have a lot of information to get through in a short period of time, but I just want to start by thanking everyone that's contributed to the State of the Ecosystem report, especially Kim Bastille, Garrett DePiper, Sarah Gaetjes, Kim Hyde, Scott Large, and Laurel Smith, who helped lead certain sections of the report. So we've seen these reports on a couple of years now, and the real goal is to improve the ecosystem information and synthesis for fisheries managers. And so we are doing this as part of a larger integrated ecosystem assessment, where we've determined goals and objectives, looking at broader legislation, and then want to develop indicators and assess the ecosystem by providing that contextual information to you all. The reports are very much an iterative product, so they've been evolving since 2016. And you can think of them as sort of a fisheries relevant subset of a larger swath of indicators that you would see in a more full ecosystem status report. And we do employ open science emphasis on things. And so all of the data, or most of the data, and all these slides and the processes are open. The structure for this year's report is very similar to the report that you received last year. We felt that worked really well. So there's a graphical summary up front. So the first two pages are sort of report cards relative to management objectives. Then there's a page on risk summary bullets, then a page on some synthetic themes that we've been trying to weave in throughout the report. And then finally, the bulk of the report is broken into two sections, one on performance relative to management objectives, going into more detail of what's on the status cards, and then a risk to meeting management objectives, which is that risk summary bullets in more detail. And so you're not meant to read these. They're just to show you what the front couple pages look like. So for this report, we are looking at the Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank, two of our ecological production units. So that first page is for indicators that are sort of specific to the two regions. And then that third page is indicators that are common to both regions. And then this is the page that has all the bullets for the two risks to meeting fisheries management objectives, namely climate and other ocean uses and offshore wind. The synthetic themes that we came up with last year that we've tried to carry through this year are characterizing ecosystem change for fisheries management through looking at multiple system drivers. So those are the societal, biological, physical, and chemical factors that influence the marine ecosystem through a variety of different pathways. And in looking at those multiple different drivers, seeing if there's changes that can lead to regime shifts, so these large, abrupt, persistent changes that change the structure and function of the ecosystem. And then looking through those regime shifts and changes and see if there's any multiple system drivers interacting in a different way that we think that there might be ecosystem reorganization. And this, of course, would influence how species and humans respond and adapt to the new environment. Just some orientation for the document as you're reading through it. There's actually two of these reports. There's one report that we sent to the Mid-Atlantic Council, and that covers most of the indicators of the Mid-Atlantic Bight. And then the New England report that you have in front of you that covers Georges Bank in the Gulf of Maine. These slides will be available online and you can click through these, but there's a glossary of terms. So if anything's not familiar to you, as well as a more detailed technical methods for the document. The document's written more in plain language or trying to be more plain language. So a lot of the real technical details are in a separate online compendium. And then the indicator data themselves are available to download if you want to take a look at it. Many of the figures are standardized, and so this is just sort of an example on the right where we have trend lines put on if there are significant trends over a 30-year time period. If the time series is less than 30 years or there isn't a significant trend, you won't see that the line on there. And we color-coded them that orange and purple because on some of the figures, it can be hard to tell which way the line is going. And then there's also a shaded area at the very end just to highlight the last 10 years to see if there's any recent trends that are different than the overall trend. The main sections are broken down, as I mentioned, to performance relative to management objectives and the risks to meeting fisheries management objectives. And both these sections are very similar in that we say what an indicator is saying, whether it's up or down or stable. And then we try and answer some why questions of why we think it's changing, and trying to integrate those synthetic themes. The objectives that we've come up with are largely drawn, like I said, from national legislation. So we're looking at seafood production, profit, recreational opportunities, stability, social and cultural, and protected species. The risk to meeting fisheries management objective, exact same thing. What are the indicators saying and why do we think it's important for managers? And then the two big risk categories that we have are climate, so warming oceans and currents, acidification, habitat, productivity change, species interactions, community structure changes, and then also looking at other ocean uses, which is predominantly offshore wind at this point. So now I'll dig into the bulk of the report, performance relative to management objectives. And so the first one that we have is seafood production. You'll see in this presentation a couple places where some figures are grayed out a little bit. That's for two reasons. One reason being that we still had some disruptions from COVID that maybe some things were not collected or we didn't have enough data to provide an update, but we felt they were important enough to still leave in the report. Or as in the case here, the Science Center is switching over to their the catch assessment and monitoring system, the CAM system, along with the regional office. And it wasn't quite ready in time for us to have the regional breakdowns for some of the commercial landing data. So in those situations, we actually looked at some coastwide landings to talk about some of the trends. And we feel that we're not actually expecting some of these longer term trends to change with just one data point missing. So we still repeated them. Looking at the coastwide landings from federal fisheries management plans, there were some mixed results in 2020 when compared to recent five-year average. The landings of brownfish were up, while things like monkfish and scallops were down, and lobster landings were also decreased in 2020. Take a look at a recreational harvest there on the top right. So this is looking at the portion of catch that's retained most likely for consumption. You can see that we're actually at a low point in the time series, and we've had a significant declining trend over the course of the whole time series. And then that figure on the bottom right there is recreational shark landings. And so we've seen decrease over the last few years in those. A lot of that is driven by regulations, especially trying to protect restricted species. Looking at stock status, so you're probably familiar with these COBE plots that you might see on an individual species, but we've put all of the species on there. And so right now, for managed stocks by this council, there's 8 stocks with reference points below BMSY, and there's an additional 13 stocks that don't have specific BMSY reference determinations, which of course doesn't mean that they're necessarily overfished, but they couldn't be put on this plot in that manner. Currently, there's no stocks that have specified F reference points that are above the overfishing threshold, but we do still feel that the stock status and associated management constraints are likely contributing to some of the decreased landings that we've been seeing. Over on the right, this is just the Georges Bank survey biomass. It's aggregated into various guilds. And so the trends that we've been seeing from the scientific surveys is that it's relatively stable with a few positive trends mixed in there. But the managed species make up a varying proportion of these aggregate groups, but the landings are not mirroring the overall trophic structure of the survey sampled fish and invertebrates. Revenue is sort of a similar case where we don't have the regionally specific revenue that once again will come from CAMS once it's done. We do find that, oh, I missed a slide. No, no. Sorry. The implications for the CFIR production is that we're seeing declines in commercial landings, most likely driven by the requirement to rebuild individual stocks, as well as some market dynamics. There's other drivers that could be affecting the recreational landings. I mentioned the shark fishery management and possibly some survey methodology. As we move forward, thinking about seafood production, we need to continue to monitor a number of things, climate risks, including warming and ocean acidification, and shifting distributions will play a large role here, as well as ecosystem composition and product production changes and engagement in fishing activities. And we'll touch on some of these later in the report. You can see there on the right, those are the long shelf trend on the top. So things are continuing to move sort of further north and into deeper waters. And that's an aggregate index of about 48 species. Now we're getting to profit. So I jumped the gun a little bit on myself, but this is another area where we don't have the CAMS data, so we can't break things out regionally. Although, as I mentioned with the landings, we don't really anticipate the long-term declining trends for managed species to change, particularly in the Gulf of Maine. The coastwide estimates did indicate a decline in revenue compared to 2015 and 2019 for a number of species managed by the council, as well as lobster. We do see continued reliance on sea scallops and lobster in the region. And of course, those two species are both very sensitive to ocean warming and acidification. So again, something to continue monitoring as we move forward. The recreational opportunities. So here we're taking a look at the diversity of the fleets, where fleets are defined as private vessels, shore-based fishing, or party charter vessels. There was an increasing trend in this until about 2010 or so, and then we've been seeing a decline since, returning to about the time series average. There's no long-term trend one way or the other. The species diversity is also at or about the time series low, but right around that average, showing the reliance on those two species. But the abundance of any long-term trend in this data suggests that there's relative stability in the overall number of recreational opportunities in New England. So for stability, the objective stability, we actually look at a few diversity metrics as a proxy for stability, assuming that if diversity remains constant over time, the system's capacity to respond to change should remain about the same. Although recognizing that changes in diversity are not necessarily indicating a problem or an improvement. And we do have two sort of components to stability, looking at stability in fisheries and stabilities in the ecosystem. And so here we have the commercial fleet count and the commercial fleet diversity. Not picking up the trend, although they are at lower points in the time series as of now. Here, fleets are defined as a combination of the gear type and the vessel length category. And then looking over at the recreational data, again, we saw sort of no trend in the makeup of the fleet. The species revenue is decreasing, but no significant trend line yet. But the species catch diversity has been increasing over the time series from inclusion of warmer water species as well as regulations on some of the more typical New England species. For as far as the ecological metrics go, some of them we weren't able to sample due to, as I mentioned before, the COVID pandemic, as well as some lags in some of the processing of the samples. We do have there on the top right the expected number of species from the bottom trawl survey, where we saw an increasing trend during the albatross portion of the time series, the first part there in the red, for the Gulf of Maine. We did break the time series at the conversion to the Bigelow just because there's no sort of conversion for the species that you catch. Although those lines do look to be sort of continuing from where they were, we do see a little bit more of a disjoint in the Mid-Atlantic report. That's why they've been separated there. So some of the implications from this work is that the commercial fisheries diversity is driven by a small number of species, which could indicate a diminished capacity to respond to future fishing opportunities. The recreational distribution diversity is due to species distributions and regulations, with adult diversity in the Gulf of Maine suggesting an increase in warmer water species as well. Next, we get into environmental justice and social vulnerability. And so here we're looking at social vulnerability as a measure of the community's ability to adapt to change. The figure on the left there shows the top 10 engaged and the top 10 reliant New England ports, where engagement is a measure of the number of permits, dealers, landings in a community, and while resilience is that engagement on a per capita basis. Communities that you find in the top right quadrant of that plot are both highly engaged and highly reliant on commercial fisheries. In addition, this year we are looking into environmental justice indicators. And so communities that are in orange on that plot are ranked in the medium high to high in social vulnerable criteria, which are the poverty index, the population composition index, and the personal disruption index. And you can see that on a spider plot to the right, which one of those indicators is above the threshold, with the dotted line being the medium high and the solid line being the high. So a port like New Bedford scores high on all three of those categories. And you can take a closer look. And so these communities that have environmental justice concerns could be more vulnerable to changes in fishing patterns or regulation or changes in climate change, and may have a lower ability to successfully respond to those changes. Taking a look at the same kind of information, but now from a recreational point of view, the first thing you'll see is that there's no communities in New England that score high on both engagement and reliance as far as recreational things go. And that also none of these communities are rated medium high or higher on the environmental justice indices. We'll note that Narragansett or Point Judith, Rhode Island, and Newington, New Hampshire show up in both the commercial and recreational figures, but both score low on the environmental justice indices, which means that environmental justice is may not be a major concern in those communities at this time, based on the indicators that we have. Finally, we have protected species. And so in the past, we've sort of looked at bycatch of harbor porpoise and gray seals. Because of the low observer coverage in 2020, we weren't able to update these indicators. As of last year's report, they were both still meeting the criteria, although we did notice that the gray seals, the 1 year average was above the threshold, although the 5 year moving average was still below. So we believe they're still meeting objectives. And this downward trend that we saw in the harbor porpoise bycatch is due to a decrease in the harbor porpoise abundance in US waters, reducing the overlap of fisheries and decreasing gill net effort, while the increasing trend in gray seal is related to the increase in gray seal population based on the US pup count. And I have a slide on that in a little bit. The other species of concern that we look at is the North Atlantic right whale. You've seen this story before. Things were increasing until about 2010, and now things have been going down, and they're continuing to go down. It's estimated right now that there's about 100 adult females remaining in the population. Looking at the bottom figure there is the pup count. And so, you know, we've been seeing a general decline in calves since about 2009, to the point where we actually had zero calves observed in 2018. Luckily, we've been seeing those numbers increasing over the last few years. So there was 7 in 2019, 10 in 2020, and the preliminary observations for 2021 was that there was 18 pups born. And so, North Atlantic right whales, of course, continue to be an important topic, especially with their interactions with commercial fisheries and ship strikes and changing distribution shifts due to climate change and copepod availability. Additional potential stressors on the right whale will include offshore wind development, which overlaps with some of their important habitat areas that are used year-round by the right whales, including some areas that the mother and calves migrate through and use as foraging habitat. And there's still a few unusual mortality events that are continuing for three of the large whale species. So now we'll move on to the risks to meeting fisheries management objectives. And as I mentioned, this is broken into climate change and offshore wind. Here we see, again, that ocean temperatures are continuing to warm up both the surface and the bottom. So on the right is the sea surface temperature, and then on the bottom left, you're looking at the bottom temperatures. So the seasonal sea surface temperatures in 2021 were above average throughout the year, with a few of the seasons even rivaling or exceeding the record warm temperatures that we saw in 2012. And that is probably connected to the figure on the top left there, where you see the Gulf Stream is continuing to shift northward, which of course is associated with warmer ocean temperatures. And since 2008, we've really seen a reduction in the supply of the cold freshwater from the Labrador Current that enters into the shelf, and that's that middle figure there. And the expectations are that 2020, we're going to see the Gulf Stream stay at a fairly north position. So we're going to see this pattern continue for next year. And so that is, of course, contributing to a large number of marine heat waves. And so these frequent marine heat waves of moderate to severe intensity, where heat waves are defined as warming events that last for 5 or more days with a sea surface temperature above the 90th percentile of the historical daily climatology. And so that's that black line if you're looking closely on this figure. And so you can see that a good majority of the year was above that threshold. Georges Bank experienced 6 distinct heat waves throughout all seasons in 2021, which include the warmest event on record. And we've seen the strongest 4 marine heat waves on record for Georges Bank occurring in the last several years. The Gulf of Maine was equally effective, with over 80% of the year experiencing a marine heat wave that lasted all the way through to December. And so over there on the right figure, you can see the cumulative intensity and the daily, the maximum intensity of some of these heat waves. And obviously that we're seeing an upward trend in all of those indicators. And a lot of that, you know, coupling the position of the Gulf Stream and the warmer temperatures, we're seeing a much more frequent warm core ring. So that's the figure on the top right there. You can see that since about 2000, we've actually been in a different regime where we're seeing much more frequent warm core rings. And that figure in the bottom right is actually a very anomalous picture where 8 distinct warm core rings were observed on one single day. And this was in June. And when those warm core rings move onto the shelf, it of course can alter habitat and disrupt seasonal movement of fish. The top left panels there are indicators of the cold pool, which is a feature more associated with the Mid-Atlantic, just off the southern flank of Georges Bank. But it's obviously a very important habitat. It provides a nutrient reserve pool and is prime spawning and foraging habitat for many early life stages of species, and particularly yellowtail flounder. And what we're seeing is that it's getting warmer, smaller, and the duration of how long it persists is getting shorter over time. On the bottom left, we've seen indications of ocean acidification And so the bottom pH varies spatially and temporally. The pH gets decreases with depth, which means getting more acidic, with some of the minimum values being found in the deeper waters of the Jordan and Wilkinson Basin in the Gulf of Maine. Luckily, we don't think that we're reaching any threshold for some of our species yet, but something to continue to monitor. Looking at primary production, so over there on the left, the phytoplankton blooms were above average in winter, but below average during the typical spring bloom in both regions. And summer concentrations were also low, but there was a high fall bloom in both regions. And so the spring and fall blooms are typically dominated by larger celled microplankton, which of course can find their way up the trophic levels better, provides more energy to the upper trophic levels than the smaller nanoplankton cells that dominate in the summer. And over on the right, you can see sort of the proportions that we saw throughout the year as compared to the climatology for that region. So we saw a little bit of a decrease than average for both groups. This increased production by the smaller phytoplankton, though, can imply that less efficient transfer of primary production to the higher trophic levels. And so we should continue to monitor, especially with information that we've gathered of increasing gelatinous zooplankton and krill. Our other zooplankton indicators were not updated again due to the lack of the survey and the lags in the processing. Once again, we're including the forage energy concentration, or the density, forage energy density of a lot of our forage fish. Again, this varies a little bit temporally between the two seasons, although majority of the species are about the same energy content that we saw in the 90s and 80s. The big exception, of course, being the Atlantic herring, which we're seeing in a much lower energy concentration than the studies that were done in the 80s and 90s. And so these fluctuating environmental conditions and prey for forage species can affect both their abundance and their energy content. And then looking here, we're looking at the fish condition over a range of different species where the darker colors represent poorer condition, and the lighter colors represent better condition. And so we had a period in the middle time frame there where large portions of fish were experiencing bad conditions. And in the recent years, though, we've been seeing more favorable fish condition factors, including this past year, where many were in good shape. We saw many species in New England improve conditions in 2021. With the preliminary results of synthetic analysis show that changes in temperature, zooplankton, fishing pressure, and population size influences the condition of the different fish species. One of the indicators we brought back this year was taking a look at the sort of small to large fish productivity anomaly. So we saw a pretty clear pattern in the mid-Atlantic, not so much of a pattern here in New England, but with a few exceptions, the later period of time, we do find that this indicator of productivity is below average. Looking at sort of trends in major predators, we didn't see any trend in some aggregated shark groups. Over there on the right is another COBE plot looking at highly migratory species, so your sharks and your billfishes and your tuna. And so many of them are above their threshold for BMSY. Some are experiencing overfishing, some are not. But they seem to be a fairly robust predator population that's out there. This is looking at the gray seals pupping. Again, this was from a report now published a couple of years ago. There is no update to this figure, but again, just to show that on three of the four breeding sites in the U.S., we're seeing this exponential growth in gray seals. And so at the time that this was published, there was about 27,000 U.S. gray seals, which is minor compared to Canada's population, which is 425,000. And we saw Canada's population increasing at about 4% per year, with U.S. pupping sites increasing from one in 1988 to about nine in 2019. And of course, harbor and gray seals are generalist predators and consume more than 30 different prey species, including many of the species that are managed here. So the implications are that there is a stable predator population or even a slightly increasing predator population that would have impacts on the rest of the food web, especially if these predators continue to increase. This table works a lot better on the HTML version, so I apologize. This is a PDF version of the slide. But once again, we're looking at the habitat vulnerability, and we link several of the New England fishery management species to several highly vulnerable nearshore habitats. One good example from this table that you can click on through the report and play around with if you want is winter flounder, which is a species that's deemed highly vulnerable to climate itself and is linked to highly dependent or vulnerable habitats throughout New England and the Mid-Atlantic. And next we get to offshore wind. And so as of February 2020, there was 24 offshore wind development projects proposed over the next decade. And it's anticipated that this is going to cover about 1.7 million acres by 2030. And you'll see that update on that figure, that last data point is past to 2030. And that includes the New York wind energy areas that were just recently leased, as well as Gulf of Maine, potential Gulf of Maine sites. And so right now there's plans for just over 2,500 foundations and more than 7,000 miles of cable proposed to date. And the figure over on the right is color coded, and you can see it a lot better in the report, but it gives you an idea of about when the dates are for them to begin construction on the various sites, with no one area really getting developed all at once. But offshore floating wind is expected to be developed in the Gulf of Maine. Right now, there's no commercial wind areas proposed, but the state of Maine has submitted an application to BOEM to lease 15 square miles for a floating offshore wind research site in federal waters. Commercial lease areas designations are expected to start in 2023, with lease sales probably occurring in 2024. On the very last column of that sort of colored chart there, you can see some of the state's current energy goals. And it's expected that the energy goals for Maine, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts that aren't met through the Massachusetts, Rhode Island wind energy area are going to come from development that's going to occur in the Gulf of Maine. So something to continue to monitor. The revenue in the lease areas, and somehow lost the figure off of here, so I apologize. I don't know how that happened. But so we took a look at using the federal vessel logbooks and calculated the average commercial fisheries revenue that is occurring in the current wind energy areas. And it represents anywhere between 1 to 12% of the total annual revenue from some of the most affected fisheries from 2009 to 2019. The largest portion for here is the sea scallop fishery can be affected with a maximum of about 12% annual revenue coming from wind lease areas. There should have been a figure there. Hopefully you can find it in your report on looking at revenue by ports. And so there, let me just look at it. Let So what you would see there is sort of a portion of revenue for the ports sort of ranked from highest to lowest. So New Bedford's the top port on that figure. And then you'll see a dark blue bar at the beginning, and that's sort of the minimum amount that we saw coming out of the wind energy areas. And then a medium blue bar that is sort of the range from the lowest to the highest. And then we also noted which ports had environmental justice concerns as well as gentrification issues. So I apologize that didn't come through. In addition to that, BOEMS reported that cumulative offshore wind development could have moderate impacts on low-income members of environmental justice communities due to disruptions to fish populations, restrictions on navigation, and increased vessel traffic. So some of the final implications here are that we see anywhere from 2 to 69% of port revenue from fisheries currently comes from the areas proposed for offshore wind development. And some of those communities may have environmental justice concerns or gentrification vulnerability. Up to 12% of the annual commercial landings and revenue for major New England species occur in the lease areas. And as I mentioned before, development will affect species differently, negatively affecting species that prefer soft bottom habitat while potentially benefiting species that prefer hard structure. And the planned wind energy areas overlap with one of the only known right whale foraging habitats, and altered local oceanography could affect right whale prey availability. Depending on developments may also bring increased vessel strike risk and potential impacts of pile driving noise. And so that figure over the right is a distribution of North Atlantic right whales and overlaid with the wind energies areas. So as I said, there's over 60 contributors from 14 institutions, and there's no way we could pull together all this information without their help. So big thank you to all of them. All of the information that I showed in these slides, the technical documentation, the indicators themselves, some of the visualization, you can find all those resources here. So if you go to the link, you can click on all these and get all the information. So with that, I will take any questions from the council. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Lissy. So I have a question for you. We have Dr. Kerr, chair of the SSC, is going to give us their recommendations on this report. What I'd like to do is take a break right now and allow the council to check out, or anybody's got to check out, and then regroup at 10:45, get her report, and then take questions for both of you. Does that work for you, doctor?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, we're on break till 10:45. Thank you.